comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth, thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. And for those of you who are residing in the USA, I hope you had a very happy and wonderful July the 4th holiday. It's a big deal here in the States, July the 4th. It's our national birthday. And so I hope you had a great holiday. Last Friday, we had a caller from Ireland by the name of Darren. And you may remember this. I thought that he was beginning to say something political. I misunderstood what he was saying, and I misunderstood his intentions, and I cut the connection, which I do when people start moving into politics. I thought that's what was happening, but I now know that I was mistaken, and I apologize to Darren for that. I make mistakes like anybody else. Once in a while they're right out in public like that one. So again, Darren, my apologies, and I hope you will call us again. My guess, and I'm only guessing, but my guess is that you have at one time or another given some thought, some consideration to the question of the origin of, well, us. Where did our species come from? How did we come into existence? Some people think, well, that's been settled. I mean, you know, Charles Darwin and his theory of evolution settled that. It's far from settled, my friends. That is a theory. Far from being well supported by the forensic evidence. And there are many theories about how we got here. Not just how did we get to Earth, but how did we become what we are? Well, our guest tonight is Michael Tellinger. And Michael Tellinger has both written and lectured on this topic for a couple of decades, and he's going to join us tonight, as a matter of fact, from South Africa. That's where he lives. And we're going to be talking about that question and a lot of other deep and mysterious questions here on The Kevin Smith Show tonight. We may or may not be able to open the telephone lines for you, depending upon our international connection that we have with Michael Tellinger, but we certainly will try to do so. And if we can, we will. If we cannot, then we just have to go with what we know. Be sure you write the phone number down, though, just in case. We'll be back right after this. Thank you. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest, as I said, is Michael Tellinger. And I think probably most of our audience is well familiar with him, but for those who are not, and even for those who are familiar with him, you may not know a few things about Mr. Tellinger. Michael Tellinger graduated from Wits University in 1983 with a bachelor's degree in pharmacy. He's been very active in the entertainment field for quite some time. He's an actor. He's a singer, songwriter. He is one half of the group Sterling and Tellinger, the other half Russell Sterling. They played together for 4 years, had music hits with Call Me and What's a Nice Girl Like You Doing in a Place like This. They pioneered the music video market back in the 1980s in South Africa, and the Call Me video was voted among the top two most popular videos in the Midim in Cannes 1983. He's also responsible for a controversial anti-apartheid song called We Come From Johannesburg, which was banned shortly after its release. But he's not just a singer, songwriter, and actor. He's also a television producer and presenter. He created shows in South Africa like the talk show called Late Night Live and Weekend Bonus. We really could keep going with his credits here in the entertainment field, but he's also well known to a great deal of Earth's population because of his research into and writing about the question of origins. He wrote and had published a book in 2005 called Slave Species of God. Michael Tellinger, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Lovely to be talking to you and your audience.
Michael, before we get into really what I'd like for us to talk about here tonight, let me ask you this. You were really, really wrapped up in the entertainment world and quite successful in the entertainment world. You launched your own record label and launched some South African artists that did well in Germany as well. How did you get from that to writing this book in 2005 about the origin of our species?
Well, you know, it's one of those strange things. You know, life has a plan, and as many of your listeners will know, we don't really choose our journeys. Our journeys are pre-planned for us as we enter this world, and we go on these very interesting journeys. I believe somebody actually pointed out to me the other day in an interview that everything I've done in my life, especially in the entertainment industry, and then also working in advertising and so forth, has actually been the training ground for me to do what I'm able to do today. That includes my studying and, you know, in pharmaceutics and spending 5 years at Fitz Medical School and getting to learn all about the human anatomy and what makes us tick, or what we think makes us tick. So everything's really, it seems to me that everything has been a training ground for doing, which is really sharing our discoveries that we're making here in South Africa and the surrounding areas about the origins of humankind and the really amazing and startling discoveries of what we live on, which is on planet Earth.
Your formal education, being in pharmaceuticals and in medicine, 5 years of medical school, no doubt you were exposed probably heavily exposed to the theory of evolution. And this is something that all of us are familiar with because we're exposed to that theory now from the earliest levels of education. And so here you've got a degree in pharmaceutics, you've got 5 years of medical school, and you do not apparently buy this theory of evolution, am I correct?
Well, absolutely. As you say, you said it yourself, it is still a theory of evolution, and it is called that, just like the theory of relativity. And we keep forgetting these things, and unless you start studying and researching this, and a lot of people are not necessarily aware of this because it is sold to us so successfully by the media, and they often forget to call it what it is, which is the theory of such and such and the theory of such and such. So, let's put it this way. There's absolutely no doubt that evolution does take place. What kind of evolution and how it takes place is a completely different thing. Whether Darwinian evolution is really taking place on this planet or if it's a different kind of evolution is still highly questionable. And many sort of leading biologists and nuclear physicists and especially people that delve into quantum physics and genetics will tell you that Darwinian evolution is flies in the face of what they're finding in genetics, and that's a very interesting comment because. That's what we've been sold, and some schools we've been forced to teach it at school as fact, and it's no longer the theory of evolution that we're being taught. It's now just evolution. When kids come home from school, they say, "Oh, well, they're teaching us evolution at school." They don't say they're teaching us a theory of evolution. And also very importantly, what people must remind themselves from time to time is that at least 90%. Science as we know it today, that number is obviously arguable, but at least 90% of science as we know it is untested and unproven. Most of science as we know it is still just completely new to us. We don't quite understand how things work and why they work. All you need to do is speak to a few nuclear physicists and some quantum physicists, and they'll make you very, very, very quickly, they'll make you feel very inadequate about how much we really know about science and what we often call so-called the laws of physics and stuff like that. We know very, very little about those areas.
I agree with that, and I'll tell you, everybody that listens to this show frequently has heard me say I don't think there are laws of physics. What we are calling laws of physics, really, that's just descriptions of our current understanding. And some smart person will come along and step right over one of these so-called laws, and we'll have a whole new understanding. Just like when Einstein came along and, Newtonian physics was out the window.
Yeah, exactly. And, while you're talking about someone will come along, I believe I'm in a very fortunate position to be working with one such person by the name of Willem de Swart here in Johannesburg. And, he lives in Johannesburg. I live in the mountains of Mpumalanga, in right in the middle of one of these ancient civilizations and ancient settlements, which we'll talk about. But Willem de Swart, in my opinion, has broken the mold of staid and old physics and science and mathematics and geometry. And what I believe Willem has discovered is a whole new decoding and understanding of the nature of reality and the numeric grid that keeps us imprisoned in this three-dimensional vibrating universe that we believe to be our home. And once you, hopefully we'll be releasing Willem's work in the next few months. It's a complex body of work, but it's very, very exciting, and it in many ways does what Einstein, I think, was desperate to find, and that is the theory of everything, or what many scientists are trying to find, that elusive theory of everything. I believe Willem de Swart has actually discovered it by a strange sequence of coincidences.
Well, that's something that when this work is released, that's something I certainly would like to discuss on the show, and hopefully you'll help us to secure some time with Willem and get him on the show.
Yeah, it's Kevin, it is really so exciting, and I'm going to be going to Johannesburg again on Wednesday. I'm doing some talks there in the vicinity, and every time I go to Johannesburg, I spend a day or so with Willem, and we catch up on his latest breakthroughs, and then I throw in my few cents worth, and from my perception, my understanding, and what happens is we find out whether my way of seeing, you know, observing his work matches with what he's doing, and if we find common ground, we inevitably know that we've got something really good going for us. And it is so exciting because he's made it so simple to understand. The entire universe and this thing called the nature of reality, which many people still are starting to really grapple with these days, is just phenomenal. And it's just so simple. But what is staggering and what is quite shocking to discover through his work is that the so-called thing, the matrix, or this prison grid called the matrix that many people will be familiar with, is real. It is absolutely real. I think that's one of the most shocking discoveries or realizations that hits you when you start looking at Willem's work. So I'm looking forward to getting that out and starting to discuss more about that element of research and science.
All right, let's go back for just a moment to this theory of evolution and you. Your theory is not a theory of evolution, but of intervention, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, let's go back to that, Kevin. There's no doubt that there's actually room for both, a theory of evolution and a theory for creation. Because there's no doubt in our minds, or there's no doubt from scientific evidence, rather, that the human race, our species, Homo sapiens, just suddenly appeared. You know, we just appeared here on planet Earth around, roughly speaking, around 300,000 years ago. And that's what our current belief is. That might change as time goes by. And once again, we've got to be open-minded about this all the time and use the evidence and the clues that come our way to rehash our theory. Unfortunately, many people get a theory and then they stick to the theory so strongly that they discard very important evidence and clues along the way. I try not to do that. So that's why I'm saying at the moment we believe that it looks as if around 300,000 years ago, Homo sapiens just appeared out of nowhere by some fluke of miracle or coincidences. And here we are, a species wondering where we come from, why are we here, what are we doing here, and, you know, what are we made of? And then we start grappling with this thing called consciousness and spirituality, and it's leading to a lot of very confusing sets of theories and religious, you know, religious groups, and then leads to the next thing of, you know, the whole divide and conquer principle that seems to rule planet Earth. But there's definitely, as you say, very strong evidence for both evolution and creation. So I think that's an important point to start from.
When you say that there is room for evolution and creation, we understand in broad terms what you mean by evolution. But when you say creation, there are many different variations of creation as well. Some people believe that there is a supreme being who did the creating. Some people believe that there is a supreme being and then some lesser gods, and the lesser gods did the creating. Some people believe that it's the scientific actions of a group of extraterrestrials that arrived here on Earth, and they did some sort of genetic engineering that caused us. And there are a lot of other theories. Which track do you take?
Well, it's interesting. If you asked me this question a year ago or 2 years ago, I would have probably said, well, I'm taking the latter, the last of the tracks. But the more research you do, and this becomes evident in my presentations, the more research you do into ancient human history and the origins of humankind, the more you start to realize that everything is connected. And I'm talking about everything. And once again, Willem de Swart's work shows that very, very clearly. But when you start researching this area, it shows you cannot escape how, you know, the research keeps pointing towards how everything is connected. So we're dealing with some sort of a divine being or a divine creator that is responsible in some weird way that we do not understand. And we try and understand it, and that keeps tripping us up. That's responsible for all the stuff that we perceive or measure in the universe, in the electromagnetic universe. Remember that we live in an electromagnetic universe, and everything spins and vibrates. If it didn't spin and vibrate in this universe that we live in, it wouldn't be there, and we wouldn't be able to measure it or perceive it. So we have this divine creator, and then we have the creation itself, the stuff that exists that we can measure, that vibrates and spins, whether it's light or sound, or whether it's other frequencies that we can see with our eyes, or other frequencies that we can pick up with our extrasensory perceptive organs. It's all the stuff that exists in this creation. And as part of that creation is our beings and animals and plants.
Okay, Michael, we have to step away for a break, and we'll pick up right there when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, don't go away. More with Michael Tellinger right after this. Welcome back. My guest this evening is Michael Tellinger. And Michael, when we went away, you were talking about the electromagnetic universe.
Yes. It's, you know, just to put into perspective, you're talking about, you know, creation versus evolution and God with a big G and God with a small G and all these things, which is really what I deal with in my book, Slave Species of God. Unfortunately, you know, the moment you start putting God or the creator in a box, and the moment you start seeing God as some guy sitting up in the clouds with a long white beard and a stick waiting to whack you on the head when you step out of line or punish you for seven generations, then you've lost the plot. Okay, because, you know, we're dealing with a very, very mysterious environment that we live in, this thing called the electromagnetic universe, and like I said earlier, you know, if you asked me this question a year ago or 2 years ago, I would have probably answered it with one sentence, and now suddenly it gets a lot more complicated. The more research you do into these things, the weirder and stranger they become, and as I said earlier as well, you realize very quickly how everything is connected and how everything is related because of this universe, this electromagnetic universe that we live in, which is really just a function of vibrational energy and frequencies.
And everything is just a combination of vibrational frequencies that somehow makes all of this work, including me, my body, and everything that makes me tick as a human being.
Well, in fact, in your research into some of these ancient sites in South Africa, you have discovered some interesting things about vibrational frequencies, haven't you?
Exactly. This is the reason why I bring it up. Because when you start looking at some of the pioneers in modern days, in the last 120 years or so, what we would call the pioneers of frequency, there are three very important people. There are many more, obviously, but the three guys that stick out in my mind and in my research are John Keeley, who in 1888, introduced the world to levitating objects and with vibrational frequencies, with sound frequencies, crushing giant blocks of stone with sound frequencies into the finest talcum powder, drilling precision holes with sound frequency and so forth, disassociating water with frequency. And then you get Royal Raymond Rife, who in the 1930s found the cure for all disease, all with vibrational frequencies, and treating cancer and all kinds of other diseases with vibrational frequency. He was called the man who found the cure for all disease. And then, obviously, the very famous Nikola Tesla, who gave us free energy. And all of this information was removed from the mainframe of general knowledge in the general public, because it seems to be the holy grail of knowledge and the holy grail of science, vibrational frequency. Now, what is important to realize is that what these guys discovered, either by fluke or by accident or by some divine guidance, if you want to call it that, what they rediscovered is what we have discovered here, the ancient civilizations that we can trace back to probably very close to about 300,000 years back in South Africa and Zimbabwe, were using vibrational frequency and technology to mine gold and extract the gold from the ore. And the more we look at this, the more we research this, the more evident it becomes that these ancient vanished civilizations that we know absolutely nothing about, until very recently, until we started scratching around and looking at it from the helicopter and flying over these huge, huge expanses of lost cities, all of the information points in the direction that they knew everything there is to know about the use of frequency and the use of vibrational energy.
How would they have gone about generating vibrational frequency?
Well, let's rather turn that around, Kevin, and say, why did we forget how to use it? If you look through ancient scriptures and ancient civilizations and the symbolisms that they used, from the Egyptians to the Sumerians, and the so-called alchemists and the wizards of old times, they all had this knowledge. They all had this information. The Ankh, the so-called Egyptian symbol of eternal life and knowledge, the Ankh, it's just a vibrational frequency tool. It's like a supercharged tuning fork, if you want to call it that, or a tuning fork that emits specific sound and vibrational energy that can create certain things and give rise to certain things. What a good way to explain this to people is through the study of sound and sand and metal plates known as cymatics. I'm sure that you and many of your listeners will be familiar with the beautiful patterns and the complex patterns that sound waves and sound frequencies make when you put sand on a metal plate and then you put the sound through the metal plate. Just put a speaker under it and play the sound through the metal plate, and you'll see the sand on top of the plate start to turn into a beautiful shape that represents that specific frequency. And that shape is then the representation of that frequency that you are putting through the metal plate. And just think about that for a few seconds, and you realize that suddenly we can represent sound with actual physical shapes. And once you know that, you realize that that's not just restricted to sound, but to all other frequencies. That frequencies give rise to physical matter. And that's really when you start delving into quantum physics and realize that that's what this whole universe and this whole nature of reality is all about. And these guys here built millions of stone structures in southern Africa. And this is really the big discovery that we've made here over the last 3 years or so, is that we're dealing with a vast vanished civilization of probably about 50 million people that lived in southern Africa for an extended period of, at this stage, my guess is about 270,000 years before they were wiped out by the flood, the biblical flood that all ancient cultures talk about. And when they were wiped out, all that knowledge and information that they had was wiped out with them. And after the flood, we started with a much lesser knowledge and not knowing what these guys were doing.
Okay, so I guess my question about how they generated the frequencies, we would think in terms of generating frequencies with I would think with technology, you know, some type of, well, as you said, a speaker, electronics, that sort of thing. So how would they have been able to generate the vibrational frequencies? Did they have that kind of technology and it was lost, or what's the deal with that?
Yeah. Yeah, the way we stumbled upon this theory at first, which is now, in my opinion, is no longer a theory because we've measured it. We've actually measured some of these ancient structures, and they still vibrate at very specific frequencies. So we've actually, in a manner of speaking, we've uncovered and rediscovered these ancient energy generating devices that are still active and still functional today. I mean, as crazy as it may sound, that is what we've found. We're busy working on that right now, but I'll talk a little bit more in detail about that later. Let's come back to your original question here. How did they generate this energy? Well, let's go back to some of the more recent pioneers of sound and frequency and energy. And let's talk about Nikola Tesla. Many of your listeners will be very familiar with Nikola Tesla. He is really the father of every electrical circuit that we use today. And most electrical devices and electronical devices we use today, we should really thank Nikola Tesla for. However, his real discoveries, the free energy or the radiant energy that he gave the world, that was very quickly covered up because, you know, the controlling bodies or the Illuminati or whatever you want to call them, the royal political elite that have held the planet in the palm of their hands for thousands of years, they don't want us to have free energy because that gives people freedom.
Mm-hmm.
It frees them from the bondage. It frees them from the enslavement of the few that control this planet. And for those that aren't aware of that, they need to wake up very quickly and start realizing that this is really what's going on. So what happened is Nikola Tesla actually discovered and wrote extensively about the fact that the Earth rings like a bell. Okay, and he says the frequencies and the energy in the form of sound vibration comes out of the surface of planet Earth everywhere. Every square inch, every square mile of the planet rings like a bell. And if you know how to tap into that sound vibration, you can convert that into any other form of energy. So what we're really dealing with here is just understanding frequency and knowing how to convert one frequency into another, or a one form of vibration into another. And if you understand that, it's like changing gears in a car, right? It's really, really simple. We just need to start wrapping our heads around it and understanding how to use sound vibrational frequency that comes out of planet Earth for purposes of energy, generating energy that we can use for heat and light and all other sources. I'm going to come back to that later again because I think we've reached that stage already. In fact, I know we've reached that stage. So
the ancients then understood this and knew how to tap into that energy.
To the surface of planet Earth, into tapping into the sound frequency that comes out of planet Earth. And this is where it really gets exciting, Kevin, because it's through a sequence of accidents that we've stumbled upon this theory that then we started investigating, and now we realize that this is what these guys were working with. And how we stumbled upon that is when we were clearing some of these ancient stone sites, clearing the grass and started moving some of the stones that were, that you were walking on, so you wouldn't walk on the stones if we took tourists to the sites. And we started piling the stones on a pile, and suddenly I was standing on the site and I had a whole team of people there working, and I realized that every time they put the stones down, they made a beautiful ringing noise, like, and different sounds, different frequencies. Like, imagine you're piling different crystals on top of each other, or glasses, different drinking glasses, and each glass makes a different sound, like ping pong, pong pong, like you're playing a xylophone, Every time they put one of these stones down, they would ring like a bell with a different pitch.
All right, we have a break just about to take over, Mike, and what we have to do is step away for just a couple of minutes. We'll be back, folks, right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Michael Tellinger. And Michael, when we went away for break, we were discussing these stones that had this ringing sound to them as they would be piled up.
That's right. And Kevin, that's really what attracted our attention to this phenomenon. That we maybe, and I suppose it's also my musical background that suddenly perked my curiosity, that said, hold on, these stones, they don't sound like stones, Imagine if your listeners could imagine, you're digging in your backyard and you dig a hole and you got a bunch of stones and you get out and you pile them up. They don't necessarily sound like beautiful crystals or crystal glasses, but that's what we're dealing with here. The stones that we were packing and piling as we were clearing these ruins were making these beautiful ringing sounds, and I was listening to it and I went, hold on, this is not what you would expect.
And well, are they some special kind of stone, or?
Yeah, and this is again what made me go back and then go and investigate. All these stone structures now, and find out, and I realized when I went back and realized that each and every one of these original stone circular structures was built from the same kind of stone. And in South Africa, it's a very special kind of geological formation. It's known as the Hornfell stones, named after a German geologist, Herr Hornfell. But the composition of this particular stone is, it's a very homogeneous blend of silica dioxide, which is basically quartz crystal, iron and aluminium with a little bit of manganese in it. And it has a very specific property. It's what could also be referred to as a metamorphosized quartzite, and it, which was exposed to high temperatures between 500 and 600 degrees Celsius, and it creates this beautifully homogeneous composition, which gives a very dark black in color, and it has its main property is this, the fact that it has this beautiful ringing sound that sounds like a bell. It's literally like a bell. For people that come to my presentations, I carry some of these samples of these stones that I found with me, and when I ring it, when I actually pick it up and I make them ring, there's always a gasp in the audience because people just do not expect it. It's like ringing a church bell. You know, it's quite spectacular.
When you say people do not expect it, you know, we all can imagine in our minds, we can sort of hear what stones sound like if you start throwing them onto a pile. And I don't think, for most of the world, I don't think we've heard stones that ring. I know certainly I have not. Also, I don't live where you live, so I don't. I guess we don't have those stones here.
Well, interesting you say that. They are. I have seen on YouTube, interestingly enough, I have seen a few places in the United States and in North America that they have similar kind of stones, and they also call them ringing stones or singing stones. Interestingly enough, and it seems to be that this technology was exported and used all over the world. It wasn't just down here. With time, this information and this style of building and generating energy was used all over the world. And Stonehenge is one such example itself. You know, the large monoliths in Stonehenge that are made out of sarsen stone, very, very hard rock as well, just like the Hornfels that I'm talking about. The sarsen stones were brought for hundreds of miles. And they were specifically chosen for their acoustic properties. So many people aren't aware of this. But those stones themselves ring like bells. They also have very, very strong acoustic properties. And it is now my belief, now knowing what I know about these ancient civilizations here in southern Africa, the fact that they used the frequency of planet Earth, the vibrational sound that comes out of planet Earth, in combination with these stones that ring like bells, to get them activated and get them to vibrate, and channeled them down thousands and thousands of miles of so-called channels, or you can call them connecting wires if you want. Each and every one of these stone circles was connected by these channels. We'll talk about those a little bit more as well. But it starts to suddenly, you start to realize that all these ancient sites, and Stonehenge being a very good example, and I just recently visited Stonehenge, so it's still very fresh in my mind, that sound frequency and the generation of energy using sound was the main activity of these ancient civilizations. And they used that energy for everything, probably for propulsion of their craft that, you know, that crossed the universe.
All right. When you say connecting channels, are these like ditches, or are they tunnels under the ground? What are they?
No, they're actually like from the air, the aerial photographs. What I could also say at this stage to your audience is, if you get a copy of my latest book, which is called Temples of the African Gods, or if you go onto one of my websites, there are a lot of photographs to show you what I'm talking about. Beautiful aerial photography that shows these thousands of circular stone structures, each one connected by what they look like roads from the air. But very quickly, the more you know, as you start working with it, very quickly you realize that obviously these weren't roads. This was something else, because it connects. In its original state, it connected every single stone circle that we find here in southern Africa. And then as time goes by, you can see the erosion and the breakdown of the structures by later civilizations as they appeared on the scene and then reused many of these original circular structures and reused the stone to build other things. And you see the degradation of these ancient ruins.
So these channels were on the surface then. They were not subterranean.
No, they were actually like extensions of the walls. So let's just recap here, right? So we've got the earth ringing like a bell. We've explained the concept of cymatics, or the sound that comes through a metal plate and creates a beautiful pattern in the sand, right? Now imagine the stones that we're talking about in these circular stone structures, stone ruins. Imagine the stones being sand pebbles. Pebbles of sand or grains of sand, and you rise up above the surface of planet Earth, and imagine a section of the Earth being a metal plate, and there's a sound frequency coming from underneath the surface of planet Earth, and there's a pile of these stones lying there, which really seem like sand, grains of sand, in the shape of the sound that the sound frequency that comes out of planet Earth causes them to arrange themselves into that shape of that frequency. So what you've in essence done is you've created a physical representation of the energy as it comes out of the Earth at that point. And that is the main reason, the main reason why we have millions of stone circles, and yet each one is completely unique. And that was, when you start working with these things and start researching them, often you miss the most obvious things. And one of the most obvious things you miss is the fact that all these original circles were built from the same stone. Okay, so that's the first thing you miss. And it took us 7 years to figure, or actually more, it took us probably about 25 years to figure this out. Believe it or not, a simple thing is that, are all these stone ruins built from the same stone? The answer is yes. And it took that long for that simple thought to sink in and for someone to actually go looking for it. And I recently made that discovery myself. And that's when the pennies start falling like domino effect, you know. So now you've got these millions of stone circles built from the same stone that ring like bells. And each and every one of them is completely unique. Now, you ask yourself, that's not how we build houses today. Today we have a plan, and you move into a new suburb, and every house is built exactly the same way. And yet these ancient civilizations didn't do that. They built millions of stone structures, and each one is completely unique. Now, doesn't that raise immediate questions? Why the hell would they do something like that?
It does indeed. We have to step away for break. We'll be back more with Michael Tellinger right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Michael Tellinger. He's joining us from South Africa. And wow, if you are just now tuning in this second hour, you have missed boatloads, universes of information. You have my sincere sympathy. But I'm glad you're here now, and I think you will be too. Michael, I had to cut you off in mid-sentence, so the floor is yours.
Oh, thanks, Kevin. I just, while I was listening to the break, I realized that you're located in Phoenix, Arizona.
I'm going to
be in Phoenix. I'm doing a tour of the United States during the 24th of August and the 24th of October, and we got Phoenix scheduled for between the 20th and the 22nd of September. So hopefully I can meet up for a cup of coffee with you and go through a lot of the stuff and meet you face to face.
Well, I would enjoy that. I hope you'll look me up when you're here.
Absolutely. So we were talking about the stone circles that are made of the same kind of stone that ring like bells, yet each one is a completely unique shape and design. They're all circular, first of all.
Let me ask you why. Why are they circular?
Well, that's why you got to come back to the whole study of cymatics and the effect of sound on matter. Like, okay, the same way that when you do the tests in the laboratory or anywhere, really, you can do it in your lounge with a speaker beneath a metal plate, and you put the sand on top, and you put a specific frequency through it, it creates these circular patterns. And from low frequencies that create very... very basic patterns, circular structures, and as the higher the frequency goes, the more complex these structures and these shapes become. And that's exactly the kind of thing that you get with all these millions of circular stone ruins here. And it's now clear that what this is the representation, so that each one of those ruins, the circular stone ruin, is actually the representation of the sound frequency, as Nikola Tesla called it. The earth rings like a bell, remember? And so the circular stone ruin is really the representation and the physical form of the sound frequency as it comes out of planet Earth, as it comes out of the surface of Gaia, Mother Earth. And now, once you've got that, so you've got these stones that ring like bells, that have created a plug point, if you want to call it that, a plug point into the natural energy in the earth, and are linked together, millions of them linked together, you start realizing that these guys are using the natural energy from the earth, the sound frequency, to use for their own purposes and their own needs. But it gets even more interesting, because the walls themselves, and this is what we've measured recently, very, very recently. We now know, I had a guy here from London. I was in the UK in May, where I did some talks at an event called Megalithomania. And I met her in Glastonbury, which is a phenomenal place, by the way.
Yeah.
For those that haven't been to Glastonbury. I believe it's very similar in its sort of spiritual and awakening modes to a place called Sedona in the United States. What I found, I met a guy there called Konstantin Pavlidis, who uses Russian technology to measure energy, the flow of energy through the human body and in the air and through the ground and so forth. So, and he measures the effect of the energy fields around the body. It is sort of the next generation of Curlian technology. And it measures the photonic emission of energy from your body at your finger in all your fingertips, and Konstantin came to South Africa a few weeks ago, and we went into all these sites, into some of these sites, and including Adam's Calendar, which we haven't even spoken about. Adam's Calendar is one of our most important discoveries here in South Africa, which is the oldest calendar site on Earth, as we know. And is directly linked to these ancient early civilizations, which we guess go back about 280,000 years. But so Konstantin came and he measured the energy flow and the effect of these structures on the human body. And it has a profound effect on your body and the organs and the flow of energy through your body. Remember, your body is an energy field, just like everything else spins and vibrates, so do our bodies. And now we know that these circular structures have a very, very severe effect on the human body and our organs and the way we think and all these things. And then another amazing thing happened is we measured the sound frequencies and the heat that comes out of these stone structures. And this blew my mind, absolutely blew me away, because this really proves without any shadow of doubt that we are sitting on live free energy devices. But we just need to figure out how to transfer, how to convert this frequency into another frequency. What we measured here, and just hold on to your hat, Kevin, we measured 72 decibels. Now, for those of your listeners who know how decibels work, 72 decibels is very loud. It's like a loud conversation or a lawnmower. Let's put it this way, about 85 decibels is the level of a rock concert. Okay.
All right.
And we measured 72 decibels of sound frequency coming out of the walls, but it is at a very high frequency, so we cannot hear it. It's at about 14.5 gigahertz that these walls vibrate and are shouting at us with energy and frequency. Now, that is just spectacular new information. And we now need to start figuring out how do we transfer and convert this frequency into a different kind of frequency, like a laser beam or anything else that we can put to use to turn into light and heat and anything else that we can use it for. Like John Keeley did in 1888 in Philadelphia, where he could levitate and crush and drill holes, all with sound frequency.
Is there any evidence that these ancient people were converting this energy to other types of energy that they could use for work?
Absolutely. And this is where it becomes really interesting. Because all of this activity, all is for one purpose only, and that's for mining. Actually, I'm not telling you the truth. I'm lying a little bit. It's for mining and for agriculture and for all the needs to support a giant mining community. But the primary objective was mining, the mining of gold, and then it seems later all the other metals, iron and copper and nickel and manganese and so forth. But gold was the primary material they were looking for, and they got it out of the ground in large, very, very large quantities. To explain the size of this operation, you need to imagine Los Angeles, London, New York put together and more, and that is how big this operation here was. Probably you got to throw Tokyo into the equation, and probably Paris and some of the biggest cities in the world and Mexico. Throw all of those together, and that's probably the extent of this ancient civilization here. That's how far and wide these stone structures extend across the entire Southern Africa. I'm talking about South Africa, Zimbabwe, Botswana, and parts of Mozambique. Lesotho, Swaziland, and across the Zambezi, north of Zimbabwe into Zambia, and across probably even further north. And we're dealing with very dense settlements here, very dense human civilizations. And before I published my new book called Temples of African Gods, I didn't want to just put out a book and speculate on how many of these structures there are. So I wanted to count them and actually have some sort of a scientific support and argument for how many, you know, stone structures there are, how big the civilization might have been, how many people lived here, because you need to know that to be able to put a picture together of this whole vanished civilization. So just to give you some background on this, because this is not a new obsession for your listeners that are not aware of this. The obsession of the ancient civilizations in Southern Africa goes back 500 years already. It's not something that just happened the other day. You know, when the Portuguese settlers started arriving here in the late 1800s, already then they started writing about coming across these vanished civilizations, these ruined cities and ruined structures, stone cities that they were coming across. And they had no idea who built them. When they asked the local people, you know, who built these
these ruins and where do they come from, the local people that lived here, the Bantu tribes, didn't know. They said, you know, often they would say, well, they don't know who built it, but it must be the work of the devil because the humans cannot build stuff like this. And this also, incidentally, includes the famous ruins of Great Zimbabwe. For your listeners may be aware of Great Zimbabwe ruins, which are spectacular. They fall into probably the most spectacular ruins in the world. And that was most likely, based on my current research, most likely the head office of this vanished civilization. And now we start getting into some very interesting areas, because it looks like the Sumerian entity Enki was responsible for building Great Zimbabwe. Just to throw this at you, I know I'm digressing a little bit, but there's just so much information. One tends to digress, so it's very easy to digress.
Well, that's quite all right. It's quite all right. Let's go where it goes.
Here, Jan Heine discovered Adam's calendar in 2003, as I mentioned. It is, as far as we know, the oldest calendar on Earth today. It's about 280,000 years old, based on our current belief and our research, and all the evidence points towards that point in time in human history. Adam's calendar, Great Zimbabwe, Naphtha Playa, and Great Pyramid of Giza are all aligned along the 31 degree east longitudinal line. Now, you know, that is not a coincidence. What is also important to know is that the ancient cultures used language based on numbers, and words had very specific meanings and powerful, and were assigned values in terms of numeric value. So each letter of the alphabet had a value, and then the words would be structured based on the power and the importance of the word. And if you take Hebrew and you take the word Elohim, the original name for the gods in the Bible, the Elohim, the biblical gods, which incidentally was plural, the gods, the numeric value for Elohim is 31. And all these ancient structures, Adam's calendar, Great Zimbabwe, Great Pyramid of Giza, all built along the 31 degree east longitudinal line. So do you think these so-called biblical gods, or the Anakim or the Anunnaki, which I believe are responsible for all this, that Zechariah Sitchin writes about in great detail, do you think they were trying to tell us something? My guess is yes. They were most certainly trying to tell us something, and encoded and imprinted in where they built their structures. So let's get back to how many of these ruins are there in southern Africa. So I started counting them. And as I mentioned, Great Zimbabwe is part of this. It's probably where Enki established his stronghold, and I call it the mine manager's house. And if you grew up in a gold mining community like I did, it's very easy to find, you know, where does the mine manager live when you arrive in a small mining village. Just find the hill, find the biggest house on the hill, and that's where you'll find the mine manager. But nothing has changed. You know, they did the same things in ancient times. The mine manager had the big house on the hill, and the Great Zimbabwe ruins is that big house on the hill, in among these millions of other structures. So by 1891, there was a brilliant British archaeologist called Theodore Bent, who traveled extensively through southern Africa, and I think he traveled around here for about 2 years, and he did a lot of work and research on these ancient ruins, the stone structures of southern Africa, including Great Zimbabwe. He was actually the first guy to excavate Great Zimbabwe in great detail, and he left us a phenomenal amount of information about that ruin and the fact that it was a gold mining civilization that lasted for many, many, many thousands of years. And he gives us a lot of information to support what we are now rediscovering. And at that stage, Theodore Bent estimated that, and this is in 1891. And remember, he didn't have the benefit of aerial photography and satellite photography and things that we have today. Then by 1974, there was another author in South Africa called Roger Summers, and he wrote a number of books on the lost, vanished civilizations of southern Africa. And he estimated, and he did a beautiful calculation, that there were about 20,000 of these stone structures scattered around southern Africa. Now, you know, when you hear something like this and you read something like this, you've got to put it into context of what we know about this part of the world. And what do the current history books tell us about it? Well, that kind of information flies in the face of any current history book, because our current history books tell us very clearly that Southern Africa was a sparsely populated country until about 1,000 years ago. There wasn't much here. In fact, they tell us there was very little here. There weren't more than maybe 5,000 people that lived here until about 1,000 years ago. This is what our current history books tell us.
Right.
Well, that's not the case when you start researching even the estimate of how many stone ruins there are. And if somebody says, well, there's about 20,000 of these, it suddenly sends shockwaves through the current belief system. You know, it flies in the face of what we think we know. And so that's very important information.
Yeah, 5,000 people would have been excessively busy if they had to build 20,000 of these stone circles.
Well, thank you for picking up on that. You know, sometimes I have to, you know, shove it down people's throats. You know, each one of these people built himself five cool ruins or four very cool stone structures. I don't think so, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you start looking at it from the aerial photographs that we have and satellite photography. Google Earth becomes very valuable in this research, obviously. And once you know what these things look like on the ground, but again, you've got to do the work. You've got to do the legwork. You've got to walk through the fields and walk through the bushes and the lands and under the thorn trees. And the place is thick. You know, we call it the bush here in South Africa. And the bush, we call it the bush for a reason, because it's thick African bush. A lot of these areas you can't even walk through because it's thick bush. You know, thorn trees with big tall grass and so forth. So it's inaccessible in a lot of these places. So once you've crawled under these and hacked your way through these bushes and figured out that these stone circles are everywhere, even though there are trees and grass growing through it, they're still there. You can start looking at it from the Google area, Google photography, and realizing where and how widely, how widely these stone circles are spread. So I started counting this, and I came up with a startling figure of about 10 million of these stone structures. And that was a shock to me. You know, I just didn't expect that.
Well, see, now we're way beyond the possibility of 5,000 people.
Well, exactly. So what we know now is that there was an ancient civilization that we know absolutely nothing about that vanished. They completely just vanished off the face of the earth. They were mining gold. There's no doubt about that, and we must come back to that to still talk about that gold thing. And they vanished off the face of the earth. And currently, my belief is, and I make this belief and this theory based on a lot of the evidence that we find, is the fact that this so-called biblical flood, this global event that happened around 13,000 years ago, and all ancient cultures talk about such an ancient event. Many scientists have shown that there was a huge cataclysmic, destructive force that happened around 13,000 years ago, and that seems to be the event that wiped out this ancient gold mining civilization down here. The Sumerian tablets tell us an interesting thing. If you read Zechariah Sitchin.
Okay, we just lost your audio.
I beg your pardon?
Yeah, we just lost your audio after you said if you read Zechariah Sitchin, so we missed about 5-6 seconds of your audio.
Okay, Zechariah Sitchin talks about the flood, as the translations in the Sumerian tablets call it, the deluge, and he talks about the flood emanating from Antarctica, from the southern pole, and spreading like a giant wave all across planet Earth to the North Pole, and then possibly even bouncing back, and then back up again. That's how the Sumerian tablets describe this flood event, this biblical flood. And it talks about it around, well, there are many, many pointers that point to around 13,000 years ago. So, and I'm talking about modern scientific pointers. There seem to be, you know, these periodic extinction the epochs and events, but the so-called flood about around 13,000 years ago seems to be a really big one. Well, many of these giant stone settlements that we have discovered here are covered by soil, covered by sand. And we find seashells on tops of the mountains and fossilized fish, and so it goes. There's no doubt that there was a large volume of water that came here and destroyed this civilization. I'm convinced of that. And then what happens? We have 13,000 years of rain, so many of the stone ruins that were on tops of the mountains were washed clean of the sediment and started to show themselves again, which means that when the later civilizations started moving into southern Africa, the new arrivals from the north started moving in here, and they started finding these stone structures, they started to use them and reshaping and remolding them for their own purposes. But these structures are not just, you know, as I mentioned, these stone circles connected by these channels, connected each and every one of them in its original context and its original form. But they're also surrounded by thousands of miles of agricultural terraces. So, you know, you put all this together, you realize very quickly that we're dealing with a huge number of people that lived here for a very long period of time. And they were clearly well looked after, just judging by the number of agricultural terraces that we find. They did not go hungry. And my guess is that they... the sound that comes out of planet Earth into an energy source, they use that frequency and that energy source to also help cultivate their crops and make them grow at optimal levels. I mean, we know from recent studies how certain frequencies and certain sounds help plants produce, you know, 300 and 400% higher yields of crops and fruits than under normal conditions.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll return more with Michael Tellinger right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Michael Tellinger. Michael, before we go too far away from what you were telling us about Great Zimbabwe, and that was a few minutes ago, but before we get too far away from it, let me ask you a question. You said it's your theory that it was very likely the sort of the home office and the headquarters for Enki, the Anunnaki, mentioned in Sumeria. And, of course, he's one of the beings that the Sumerians look to as a god. Is it possible that these ancient people were provided the means for harnessing these frequencies and converting these frequencies into useful energy by the gods? In other words, the technology for harnessing would be something that the gods possessed. What do you think about that?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. No doubt about that in my mind, Kevin. And all you have to do is look at the mining industry today. Look at, I can talk from experience in South Africa. The guys that work underground in the mines
are the lowest paid miners that you can find. That's how it is. They're the slave labor, whether you like to admit it or not. That's what's going on, and I guess that's the case in any other mine around the world. Do you think that these guys underground have any idea how the technology operates that they're given to use? The pneumatic drills, the electronic machinery, all the advanced technology that they are given to use and operate underground, or to get to mine the gold or the coal, whatever it is they're mining. They have no idea where the technology comes from, how it works, why it works. They just get taught how to operate it, and they operate it, and they do their job. And it's exactly the same that was going on here, 300,000 years ago, 250,000 years ago, 200,000 years ago, for an extended period of time. We had a large population of a new species that was created and cloned for one specific reason, and that was to work the gold mines. And that's very simple. It really, once that penny drops and you realize that this is the most likely history of the human race, a lot of other things start to make sense. And the technology was most certainly provided by the gods, or the Anunnaki in this case, and it talks about it. I was just reading before I came on air with you, just reading one of the little areas that I highlighted for myself in my research, and just to remind myself about the depth of information that we have about how much interaction the Anunnaki actually had with Southern Africa and the gold mines that they set up here. And they talk about the Southern Africa region in great detail, where they set up all the gold mines and where Enki came to set up the gold mining operations below the land below the equator. And it, they give it all kinds of names, and sometimes it's possibly called the Abzu as well. The Abzu is often, misunderstood, and there's still questions about what exactly does the Abzu mean, where was it? Well, my belief is that it was the land below the equator where the gold came from. That's what the Anunnaki, and specifically Enki, kept referring to, where he built his beloved city, his beloved ancient vast city of where the gold miners lived. And
okay, now you yourself, have you been to Great Zimbabwe? Have you walked through there?
I haven't been to Great Zimbabwe. I'm actually going up there in November. But it's when studying it from the aerial photographs, you can see very quickly that it's the same, exactly the same civilization.
All right, now when you look at
more impressive, yeah.
When you look at the aerial photographs, do you see in there some place where there is the largest structure, the largest house, if you will?
Yeah, well, it's the main structure. It's called the Great Enclosure. Great Enclosure is what I would call, Enki's house. And not far from it is another more impressive. It's called the Acropolis, actually, as well. On top of the little outcrop, we call it a kopi here in South Africa. On the little rocky outcrop, there was another structure overlooking the Great Enclosure. But that definitely seems to be, among all these millions of stone ruins, that seems to be the most impressive one by far, and most likely the candidate for the residence of Enki.
That's got to be, if you get to walk through that, that has got to be an awesome feeling to walk through what very well could be the actual residence of Enki.
Well, it is, and I tell you, you've got to, as someone who does research and someone, I like to call myself a scientist with an open mind, I want to read and explore every bit of information that lands on my desk, and that includes metaphysical information, psychic information, so areas of that would normally be frowned upon by conventional science, but unfortunately for the dogmatic scientists, this field of knowledge and information is moving rapidly into becoming mainframe science, the more we study quantum physics, the more the metaphysics becomes mainstream physics. But what I'm going with this is many psychics and people that feel energy very strongly have given us a lot of information, very important information. And what I like to do in this instance, Kevin, is to say, well, how do you turn sort of mumbo-jumbo, hocus-pocus, or potentially hocus-pocus kind of information into a scientific argument? And it's actually not that difficult, because all you have to do is to say, okay, well, if 20 or more psychics have told us exactly the same things about specific sites and specific events and people and activities and so forth, that match identically, all you have to do is to say, well, what is the statistical probability that people that have never met can tell us the exactly same things and information about these ancient civilizations and specific sites, and very quickly realize that you're dealing with a statistical probability that is, you know, several million and sometimes several billion to one. So we know we're dealing with scientific information and facts that could be argued from a scientific perspective, even if you take so-called psychic information. And all the stuff that I'm telling you has been corroborated and echoed to us by not a few dozen, but at this stage probably well over 100 psychics that have come through these ruins, and specifically Adam's calendar. And now I'd like to talk to you a little bit about Adam's calendar, because that is the most important site and the flagship in among all these millions of stone ruins and this ancient mining colony that goes back, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. And Adam's calendar is right in the middle of it and seems to be the most important site and the flagship among all these.
Why does it seem to be the most important?
Because because firstly it's a calendar, and after all these hundreds of thousands of years, we believe it is still actually accurate. It still tells us the time of the day of the year, and it fluctuates between winter solstice and summer solstice, and you can mark every day of the year on the flat calendar stone by the shadow of the setting sun. And it goes from the one edge of the calendar stone on the summer solstice right across to the other edge where it stops on the winter solstice and starts to move back. This is a phenomenal discovery that my colleague Jan Heiner made. And if it wasn't for Johan discovering this particular calendar site, which we called it Adam's calendar because we were looking for a catchy name before we published our book called Adam's Calendar, which we now in truth know is actually Enki's calendar. Enki was responsible for building that structure. There's no doubt about that. There are some interesting references to that particular structure in the Sumerian translations as well, you know, where Enki built himself a special place of observation in the deep Abzu on the edge of the cliff overlooking the valley. And guess what? This is exactly what we find. Where Adam's calendar is located, right on the edge of the escarpment overlooking the Barberton Valley, which is probably an impact crater, and that was filled with hundreds, if not thousands, of gold mines at some stage. In fact, the richest gold mine in the world is still located not far from Adam's calendar, down in the valley. It's called Sheba Gold Mine. And you start finding these very interesting names, Sheba Gold Mine, and you realize that what we're dealing with here is, well, suddenly, it hits you like a rock. that we're dealing with King Solomon's gold mines. This is where King Solomon got all his gold from, because Solomon lived about 1000 BC, and wherever he got his gold from must have been, because according to the Bible and some other records talk about Solomon, that he amassed all this vast amount of gold. He amassed more gold than any other person in history, Well, if that's true, then he must have gotten it from a very well-established gold mining operation. And when you look at the size, as I've described to you, the expanse and the absolute vastness of this gold mining operation down here, this is where he must have got his gold from.
Well, it's interesting that it is called the Sheba Gold Mine, isn't it?
Yeah, did they know something that we don't when they named it? every now and then you stumble on these little gems and you go, "Why, geez, this is crazy." You know, Sheba Gold Mine right here, and then we find what we believe to be Enki's calendar right there on the edge of the mountain, overlooking all these ancient gold mines. And just to come back to the gold mining thing, you know, people want to know, well, how do we know these were gold mines? And so let me explain that, is that there have been reports of gold mining for thousands of years here. It's not new. This is not something I've just made up. Just like the fascination of the ancient ruins has been going on for hundreds of years. Gold mining, there's mining of gold mining evidence goes back to the Romans. The Egyptians came through here. The Romans came through here around 130 AD with Antoninus Pius. The Sumerian Babylonians were here mining gold about 300 BC already. And then the most compelling evidence are the Hindus, the Dravidian Hindus, that were mining gold here about 2000 BC.
Okay, Michael, we have to step away for a couple of minutes. We have a break that's going to take over in just about 10 seconds. Let's pick up right there with how do we know that it was gold mining that was going on. We'll pick up right there when we come back from this break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on Final Approach. We have just about, oh, I don't know, let's see, 10 minutes left or a little bit less. And we're talking with Michael Tellinger from South Africa. Michael, you were telling us how you know these were gold mines.
Yeah, as I said, we have evidence of gold mining for all the ancient civilizations. That you can think of have been through Southern Africa in search of gold. And some of the most compelling evidence we get from the Hindus, the Dravidian Hindus, that were here around 2000 BC already. And brilliant work has been done over a 30-year period by a guy called Cyril Hromnick, Dr. Cyril Hromnick, who wrote a beautiful book called Indo-Africa, where he describes the influence of these early Hindu Dravidians that were here. And actually many of the traditions and names left behind actually come from their culture. They are called the Komati people. The Portuguese then call it Terra dos Macomates, the land of the Komati people. And in fact, the foundation that I'm a member of is called the Macomati Foundation, which actually was named by Cyril Hromnick. And the Komati people was the Dravidian name for a sect, a group of Dravidians that were known as gold merchants and gold miners and gold traders that were doing extensive gold mining and trading between India and Asia and South Africa, Southern Africa. So this has been going on for many thousands of years. This is not something new. But then when we get to the mystery of the real deep history, the 300,000-year-old history of human origins, these humans that suddenly appear in Southern Africa, the link to the Anunnaki, these gods, these advanced beings that seems like they cloned these early humans and created the human race for the purpose of mining gold, In Zimbabwe, there are some very interesting ruins around the Zimbabwe ruins, which have very specific features in them, which have in the past been called slave pits or animal pits or grain pits. Because you see, this is once again, this is how our minds work. We see these old structures and we see these internal structures, and the only way we can put this together is by the references that we have in our own lives and our own civilization. So we think of ancient civilizations, well, they must have kept their animals in there, or slaves in there, or some grain in there or something. And then comes along a woman by the name of Anne Pritzinger from Zimbabwe University. And she did an extensive study. She's a geologist. And she wrote a beautiful paper on the fact that these so-called slave pits or animal pits were actually extraction tanks for gold, filtration tanks for the extraction of gold. And she did, as I said, wrote a beautiful paper on this, and proves without a shadow of doubt that these were actually mining operations, and they were working with gold and extracting gold. And because there's so much gold embedded in the rock and in the stone and in the outlet valves of these so-called slave pits. So, you know, my only take out on this is that if they did keep slaves in there, those slaves must have been carrying a lot of bling on them. The fact that this is gold is no doubt about that. The Sumerian tablets tell us in great detail that this gold mining civilization was established here in southern Africa. Enki was responsible for setting up these gold mining operations. He was then also instrumental in the cloning process and the experimental cloning of this new species, which the Sumerian tablets call the Lulu Amelu, or the primitive worker. And then in there, we suddenly find the importance of Adam's calendar and another site in southern Africa, in northern Botswana, which is known as the Tsodilo cave or Tsodilo Hills site. And that is also known as a serpent worship site. The South African shamans and sangomas, the wise men of southern Africa, know these sites very well. They call them the two most sacred sites on earth. The wonderful Credo Mutwa, who many of your listeners will be familiar with, Credo Mutwa told me that Adam's calendar is one of the two most sacred sites on earth, and it is indeed where heaven mated with Mother Earth at Adam's calendar. And my take out on that is that is actually where the cloning process took place of this new species, the Lulu Amelu, the primitive worker, Homo sapiens, which we are the offspring of and the descendants of these early people that mined gold in southern Africa that started around 300,000 years ago. And it was at Adam's calendar that deed was actually done. That is why it's such an important and a sacred site.
Well, it sounds to me, I wish we had another hour to go, although you're probably very tired. Folks may not realize in your part of the world, you had to be up at 4 a.m. To start this show. And you were up before that. So it's very, very early in the morning there. I wish we, selfishly, wish we had another hour to go on this. But it sounds to me like you and those working with you have really come across what may be the most important, and certainly I would say the most startling, ancient archaeological discoveries, probably in this century. I think it probably will not be surpassed in this century. We've only got a couple of minutes here, so let me ask this as we bring this to a close. Where is this headed? What's the goal? Where do you see this going?
Thanks, Kevin. Well, I appreciate your sentiments on the importance of these discoveries, and I hope that those sentiments are shared by your listeners. We certainly believe that they are important. I wouldn't say they're the most important, but they certainly help us. As you say, where is this headed?
For me, the importance in this discovery is that we are starting to understand the origins of humankind. We're starting to understand who we are and where we come from. Because as a species, that question has not been answered successfully. And I think we're sitting right at the edge of starting to really come to grips with it and understanding it. Because only once we understand who we are as a species and where we come from, because those lines are very murky at the moment, when we know who we are, where we come from, only then can we start planning a future ahead as a species and understand why we've been so violent, so confused as a species, and so disjointed, and why it was so easy to control us by a small group of royal political elite individuals that have controlled the human population for thousands of years and ruled us through very simple divide and conquer principles and ruled us through fear and ignorance. The moment people realize who we are and where we come from, many of this fear and the ignorance will be washed away and we can start moving back towards unity and the divine principles of the divine creator, the divine being, the creator of the universe and all things in it, and discard these notions of gods with a small g that were just advanced beings who came to this planet in search of gold.
All right. Well, Michael Tellinger, thank you for being with us. If you will, stay on the phone with me for just a moment. Absolutely fascinating information, and I'll tell you what, it's the kind of information that just it blows the mind, does it not? So, you know, if you want to find out more about this, click on Michael's photograph that's on my website and kevinsmithshow.com. So just click on that, and it'll take you to his website. And it is loaded with information. There are things to read. There are things, videos to watch, photographs to look at. And I think you'll be very pleasantly entertained as well as educated at that site. For those watching on our television channel, you want to stay tuned for what's coming up next. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.